This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guests, travel writers Don George and Seth Kugel, took extended trips this past year. Don's five-week itinerary went like this: San Francisco to Tokyo, to Shikoku, to Okinawa, to Osaka, back to San Francisco, to London, to Dublin, to Wales, back to Dublin, back to San Francisco, to Singapore, to Bali, and then back to San Francisco. The five-week summer road trip that Seth took explored the American Midwest, also known as flyover country, meandering for several thousand miles between Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Fargo, North Dakota. It's never too early to begin thinking about and planning for a trip somewhere, which is why we invited them to join us on Radio Times. Don George is the editor-at-large and book review columnist for National Geographic Traveler magazine, also the editor of Geographic Expedition's online magazine, Wanderlust, Literary Journeys for the Discerning Traveler. And Don George, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's fantastic to be back. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Seth Kugel. He's the frugal travel columnist for the New York Times, and he joins us from their studio. And Seth, a great pleasure. I've been reading you. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Don, let me begin with you. What was your thinking behind this grand five-week tour that you took? What were you thinking?
Indeed. It actually came about kind of serendipitously. I had a trip planned to Japan, a family trip, basically, and then I had a speaking engagement, or a teaching and speaking engagement in Bali, and an opportunity to speak at a conference in Dublin just came up, and the week just kind of wedged itself between Japan and Bali, and I thought, why not? So it wasn't really planned as a five-week continuous trip like that, but it turned out to be, and I couldn't be happier that it turned out that way, because I just learned so much about the planet by being in so many different places in 5 weeks in a row without really having a chance to come home at all. It was really quite an extraordinary experience.
And what was the main thing that you learned? I mean, you have been traveling as a, I guess, professional traveler for 25 years. What did you learn from this five-week packed itinerary?
Well, it kind of reinforced for me what I've learned over and over again, but that people across the globe are really quite similar despite differences in background and upbringing. The things that they're talking about and that they care about, preserving the environment, making a better life for their kids, having individual freedoms. These are the themes that just resonate over and over and over wherever you are. And the importance of creativity and being able to express oneself creatively and in freedom. It was kind of reaffirming to me that this is what the people of the planet care about, and we're really united on that level, and we're all struggling together in a way. It was really tremendously inspiring to me, and the fact that it was just one place after another that I kept hearing these same themes coming up really reinforced that for me.
And Seth, you interestingly took a five-week tour of the Midwest of the United States for different kinds of reasons, but did you have a set itinerary, or did you just start in Louisiana and just 5 weeks later find yourself in North Dakota?
I actually originally tried to set an itinerary to go to like all these special events that were all over the place, and go to a blues festival here and a state fair there. But that actually turned out to be somewhat impossible. It actually did turn out to be somewhat random. I did know I was going to start in Baton Rouge and end in Fargo. The idea was to flip the classic American road trip on 90 degrees
right,
and go south to north instead of east to west or west to east.
And you wrote in the Times, a spin through the middle of my own country was exotic, revealing that you don't have to go abroad to experience new music, annual rites, and political views far different from what you'd find at home.
Absolutely, especially if you're from New York City and you've lived here for a while. We know that the country is vast and diverse, and yet still most of us on the East Coast tend to go to the West Coast, or maybe we go to Chicago, or maybe we go to Texas or something like that. And this is really true. There is this massive quote-unquote flyover country, and the people there sort of know that this is what the East Coast and the West Coast think of them. And it is actually quite different, and I totally agree with what Don was saying. People are much more similar than they are different. On the other hand, it is those differences that are very interesting. And, this is to a certain extent, it's Fox News country, whereas, you know, New York City is more NPR country. Let's be frank. And so there was a lot of very interesting political discussions that I had, although I never tried to bring them up myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have very... The average person has very reasonable opinions, which is not something you would sort of get if you just listened to, talk radio or something like that. So that was one important part of it. But another important part is just simply there's so much to see in these states. Kansas, Iowa, places where most people probably couldn't name a single attraction, and yet they're just completely mm-hmm. full of attractions. So that was another positive part of the experience.
I thought it was also interesting as you wrote, every farmer you met, you asked them, how many acres does it take to make a family farm profitable? Why was that the sort of thematic question that you had?
Well, because having no farming experience whatsoever, but yet having a big sort of interest in global economics, it's hard for me to understand how American farming can be profitable when costs are so high. So I was curious about a lot of different things. You know, how big does it have to be? Who's working for you? Are you getting government subsidies? Are you not? Mm. And just how does this thing keep going? And, I was driving through Iowa at one point, and I'm pretty much ignorant about agriculture, I'll just admit it. And
you're a New Yorker. Yeah, we get it.
It's just, you know, I eat fruit and vegetables and grains. I was driving through Iowa, and it's just endless corn and soy and corn and soy and corn and soy. And you're thinking, oh, well, corn and soy, okay, I'm going to eat a ear of corn. And then you, of course, realize when you speak to people that, you know, the soy is going largely into animal feed and the corn is going into ethanol. And you actually see this stuff close up. You're just like, there's no way people could be eating all this corn. There's just too much of it.
Don George, let me get back to you. And I'm just curious, since we do this every time there's a snowstorm in Philadelphia, we say, let's call Don George and talk about getting the heck out of here. What's a place, perhaps a place you went last year, even one on your five-week itinerary, a place that you would suggest people explore, someplace that just after 25 years you just got really turned on to?
Well, cliched as it may be, I would say Bali. Mm-hmm. I first went to Bali 30 years ago, and even back then people were saying you should have been here 25 years ago. And then I went there last year, and I went there the year before last, and people were saying you should have been here 25 years ago, and I said I was here 25 years ago. It's still incredibly wonderful. It's there's this vibrant culture there. There's a great climate. The food is fantastic. There's now a sort of an expat community that's also very interesting, and to my mind, I could easily see at some point moving to Bali.
I was
really enchanted by it once again, and just found it an incredibly fertile place, a fascinating place, friendly. I was once again blown away by Bali.
Do frugal travelers get to Bali, Seth?
This particular frugal traveler has never been to Bali, or actually to Indonesia in general. If I can answer the same question,
please.
I would just say Colombia, and the reason I say Colombia is it fits into a category of my favorite places, and that category is a place where people are. It's a great place to visit where people are not so accustomed to seeing tourists. Mm-hmm. And so that gives you the best of sort of the beauty and food and music and all that stuff that Latin America has to offer overall. And a real genuine curiosity in people that are living there about you and who you are and where you come from, as opposed to, say, if you go to Machu Picchu and you stop in Cusco, where there's like thousands of visitors, and my sense is, although people will be nice to you, they don't really want to talk about where you're from, because you're just like the 18,000th New Zealander to pass through. Colombia is still suffering a bit from its war-torn reputation, but just about the entire country is safe, and I really would encourage people to go there.
Have you been there, Don, to Colombia?
I have not. It's kind of on my hot list for this year, actually. A lot of people I know have just started going there and come back with the same kind of report that Seth just gave, that it's really remarkable.
In fact, I was looking in preparation for this show, for my own fantasy life as well. I was looking at places that are recommended, and I noticed a number of South American countries. And Don, is there a reason why all of a sudden people are talking about some of these countries?
I think there are some reasons. I mean, Peru has a burgeoning cuisine revival going on that a lot of people are talking about, and Patagonia is just really, it's an amazing place, but it's also developing a little bit more of a tourism infrastructure. Colombia is just kind of, as Seth said, it's had a very troubled past, and now it's pulling itself out of that past. So I think there are these reasons, but I also feel like after 25 years in the travel industry that there are these imperceptible movements where Eastern Europe will be the place suddenly, and then Asia will be the place suddenly, and now South America's the place suddenly. And I'm sure that 30 years from now we'll be able to look back and say this is what was happening and that's why. But right now I'm not exactly sure why, but South America does seem to be the hot spot in a lot of ways right now.
Seth, and almost literally, right, because it's the summer down there right
is,
now. I have a
exactly.
lot of friends in Brazil, and they're, like, complaining on Facebook, like, oh, my God, it's, like, you know, 90 degrees here. I got to get out of here. Yeah, exactly.
But Seth, you had a really interesting story about visiting, I guess it's some island, an island chain off the coast of Chile.
Yeah. Chiloé is
Chiloé,
the name of it. And,
yes.
And that's actually a perfect example of what Don is talking about. It's a place that, you know, my brother lived in Chile for a year, and he sort of went through there with my parents at a time where, you know, you had to take a plane nearby and then take a ferry and then get a bus and all this kind of stuff just to get there. And now they have direct flights. And it's an archipelago. I wouldn't say it has anything as stunning as what Patagonia has to offer, or the Atacama Desert for that matter. But it's a sort of a separate kind of place. You know, islands tend to remain a little culturally separate from the rest of the country. And that certainly has happened there. People definitely refer to themselves as Chiloeans before they're Chileans. They have a whole lot of sort of folklore there that if you get people to talk to you about, houses on stilts, you know, right on the harbor for fishermen, and you can stay in them now because, of course, half of them have turned into boutique hotels. It is a perfect example because it's a place where you can go and it's absolutely, you know, not, you know, quote unquote, it's not overrun yet, basically. And it's much easier to get to than it used to be.
And what did you do there? Wander? Eat,
I did a lot. I did some wandering. I did some drinking of a chicha, which is like there. It's, I guess it's sort of like apple cider, but a whole lot rougher. I stayed in one of these stilt houses, although not at all in a boutique hotel. There's still a few old fishermen descendants who will rent you a room for. I think I paid $6 for mine.
Wow.
The shower was freezing and the weather was kind of freezing, so I got out after one night because that's about my limit for not taking a shower. And I also explored some of the islands. I rented a car for one day and I kind of took off into explored some of the smaller places where tourists really haven't arrived yet.
And that's Seth Kogel. He's the frugal travel columnist for the New York Times. Also with us, Don George, editor-at-large and book review columnist for the National Geographic Traveler Magazine. And yes, we are talking about travel, trips, getaways in this hour of Radio Times. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you two tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
Lots of people buy holiday plants and then wonder what to do with them now. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how the Christmas rose got its name and how to turn that festive plant into a perennial performer. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, Some of the bloodiest fighting of the Iraq War happened during the siege of Fallujah. Now Al-Qaeda militants control the city, which could be the hub of a new insurgency. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking with two seasoned travelers and travel writers. They're helping us figure out where to go this year, how to get there, how to stay there without breaking the bank, and much, much more. Don George is editor-at-large and book review columnist for the National Geographic Traveler magazine, and Seth Kugel is the frugal travel columnist for the New York Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to share some of your adventures with us, or if you have any questions, give us a call. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Don, I spent, as you know, because you and I have done this, what, very similar show, it seems like about this time of year, about where to go, and I spend the months of the winter online, just, you know, roaming the world, trying to figure out where to go. Is that a good place to start, is to hop online and see what other people are saying about the world we live in?
I think that's a great place to start. There are multiple great places to start. I love to peruse the travel magazines and the travel sections and see what they're writing about. And then I think jumping online is fantastic. And I also just go to bookstores and go to the travel literature areas and sort of let my eye in some roam over the titles and see what interests me. And there's just so many sources of inspiration out there. I think they're all equally great, and they all offer slightly different riches. So I think it's good to take them all.
What about for you,
sure.
Seth?
Yeah, well, how about the places you've just always wanted to go, right? Like, right. I have to admit, Indonesia is, for me, I don't really actually know that much about it, except that I've always wanted to go there since I did a report on it in third grade and had to make a map of all these, like, tens of thousands of islands. So that's just sort of stuck with me. I would be remiss in not saying that the New York Times' Places to Go in 2014 will be online a week from today. So that would be a great place to get inspired.
And Don George, you want to give a shout-out to all the places that you write for as well?
Well, yes, National Geographic Traveler is always a fantastic source of great information. And Wanderlust, which is the online magazine that I edit, is a prime source of inspiration and inspiration, too.
Can you top that, Seth Kugel? No, I'm kidding here. But is there a place for a travel agent, Seth?
I definitely think that there is. That place is no longer, I don't think, to look for the best airfare between New York and Miami. But if you want, I don't particularly tend to use travel agents because I try to keep my budget as absolutely low as possible, and that involves doing a lot of research. But a knowledgeable travel agent who specializes in a part of the world can save you a ton of time. You just have to find one who's really good and who can map out a trip for you. The one thing, there's so much information online now, of course, but it is sort of hard to handle. It's like if the encyclopedia, you had an encyclopedia that was not in alphabetical order. You know, it's just overwhelming at times. And sometimes if you don't have that friend who's been there or someone, you know, a relative who lives there or something like that, a travel agent can be great. And I also should mention that for international airfare, a lot of times travel agents that specialize in a specific part of the world, especially if they deal with a lot of immigrants in your city, will often have airfares that are cheaper than you will ever find online. And they're called consolidators. And, you know, people think they're just automatically going to get the best airfare online. But that's definitely not always true. I travel to Brazil quite often, and I have yet to, every time I buy a ticket from the same travel agency, I check online for the same dates, and I always save about $100.
And what do you pay? I'm curious.
Well, I recently went to Brazil for about $689, which was just an absolutely incredible price. If you try to go over Christmas or during the World Cup, you're going to be paying over $1,000 no matter what you do. But you can often get, just at least a decent chunk of change off.
Don, do you want to talk a bit about travel agents and how you see them? And I do want to get to some callers then.
Yeah, I think that travel agents can be a fantastic resource. As Seth was saying, there are certain agents who specialize in certain parts of the world. And also there are some agents who specialize in events like the Olympics or the World Cup, and soon it's going to be impossible to get a ticket to those events unless you're working through some special agent who really is just focused on those. So I think in both ways, geographically and also sort of event-wise, travel agents can be fantastic resources.
And it seems, Don, that it looks like it's gotten more expensive to fly overseas. Has that been your experience?
Absolutely. I've been shocked.
And is that just because it's so far, or what else do you think it might be?
Well, I think it's supply and demand, and the fuel prices are going up, and airlines will take whatever they can get, and right now they can charge a lot and still get pretty much full planes. Most of the planes I've flown on recently have been full, and so, you know, their supply and demand, I think, is kicking in, and I don't see the fares coming down in the near future.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just think it's important to do a lot of, as Seth was saying, a lot of research online, and then check out actual travel agents and consolidators and see what their prices are.
Yeah, go ahead, Seth.
Oh, I was just going to add that it's also, though, important to put that into perspective. There's a lot of things about travel that are cheaper today than they were quite a while ago. I actually happen to have a copy of Arthur Frommer's original How to Do Europe on $5 a Day, which is kind of like he's the original frugal traveler. We all kind of learned from him and are still learning from him, by the way. You'd actually be surprised at what the sample airfares are there to Paris. You're looking at them and you're like, whoa, that's a pretty good rate for today, but those are in like 1950s dollars. So I think overall, if you looked, flying overseas is actually cheaper today than it was, say, decades ago, not than it was 5 or 10 years ago.
And Seth, what is your definition, perhaps even the New York Times definition of frugal?
That is an extremely complex question, but I will tell you that we are not specifically aiming at like the backpacker who will stay in the cheapest hostel available. The way I like to say it is, however you travel, I'd like to show you that you could spend much less and have the same, if not a better experience. I won't stay in a hotel in general that costs more than $100 a night, although I'm happy to stay in one that costs $7 a night.
And how about for you, Don?
I just generally try to, whose ever money I'm spending, whether it's a magazine's money or my own money,
that's
try
not
to
fair.
Spend it wisely. And I always find that not the cheapest hotels necessarily, but mid-range hotels give you I hate to use the word authentic, but I'll use it right now, but it's a more authentic sort of on-the-ground experience than a property where you might be spending many, many hundreds of dollars and be pretty much insulated from the local place. I like staying in sort of mid-range hotels where I'm hanging out with the people who actually live there, and I can ask the desk clerk where he goes for a nice meal when he wants to take his family out, and get kind of real answers that show me the real riches of the place.
I couldn't agree with that more. And I just also like to point out a trend that I really like, which is the international chains kind of slowly seeping into the local hotels and taking them over. And instead of being, you know, the inn in Bali, it's now like the inn in Bali by Marriott. So that stuff drives me a little nuts. I really do encourage people, even if they have one thing drives me nuts is when people who have like hundreds of thousands of points, you know, from their prior travels or from their work travels, end up just being sucked into staying at international chains when they go abroad. Whereas, as Don said, I mean, it's just such a different experience to stay in a mid-range hotel. Also, guest house, which is, I guess, sort of the same thing as a hotel, but more intimate. I always look for the word guest house for when I'm looking for a place to stay.
And that's Seth Kugel. He's the Frugal Traveler columnist for the New York Times. Also with us, Don George, editor-at-large and book review columnist for National Geographic Traveler magazine, editor of Geographic Expedition's online magazine called Wanderlust. And we are talking about Wanderlust and traveling the world and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. And send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coain. In fact, we have a tweet from Kathy. I visited Peru in 1988. The first and best ceviche I ever had, Pisco, was delicious, too. Don, you want to add anything to what Kathy just tweeted?
I've been to Peru and enjoyed both those. And I have to say that even though Machu Picchu is probably one of the most heavily touristed places in the world, I went there 2 years ago, and it was absolutely magical. And for anyone to sort of not put it on their list because they feel like everyone else is going there would be the wrong thing. And there's a reason why it's popular, and if you get there at dawn and there's nobody else there, it's an transporting, transcendent experience. So I would recommend it.
Thanks for the tweet. Let me see what Ellen from, it looks like Vineland, New Jersey, has to say. Ellen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be on here.
Sure.
I wanted to know about South Africa. It's a good place to retire in Cape Town or Johannesburg or any of those surrounding areas.
And why are you thinking of retiring there, Ellen?
When I went online, I was looking at certain spots there, you know, and it seems to me like they were very comfortable. The weather is nice. I like the weather, mainly the weather.
Well, I suggest that you check it out before you decide where you want to retire. But nonetheless, it's an interesting question. And I don't know, Seth, do you have any thoughts for Ellen?
Only what you just said, which is that you don't have to decide right away. You could spend a month or a 6 months or even a year there before you buy in. I think one great advantage of South Africa is people's accents. I just love those accents. That's just a plus for me right from the set.
The weather and the accents. How about for you, Don?
I've only passed through South Africa at the airport, but I have friends who live there who say it's Cape Town in particular is an amazing place with a great art scene and culinary scene and really a wonderful place to live. So, but definitely I would check it out before moving over there.
Although it sounds like you might want to recommend, Don, that she look at Bali.
I would recommend Bali all the way, but it depends on what you're interested in, I think.
Let me see. Ellen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have Kathy from Ringo's, New Jersey, joining our conversation. And Kathy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
We are going to rent a house on the beach in Martinique for the month of February.
Oh,
we're renting it with friends. There are eight of us.
Wow.
Near Diamond Rock, if you know the area, but we wondered if you have any suggestions.
Don, let me toss that first to you. Martinique.
Boy, I was in Martinique about 20 years ago, and
me
I
too.
Suspect it's probably changed. But the idea of renting a place on a beach sounds really wonderful, and I don't have any particular recommendations except to pick up a couple of guidebooks and also check out online sources. And I can't imagine you'd have a bad time in Martinique, though. When I was there, the culture was really fascinating, really interesting mix of Caribbean and French, and really wonderful.
Yeah, very, very beautiful. Seth, anything you want to add to that?
I have not been there, but I would suggest, and this is a little bit more ambitious, but you can now sort of connect with regular old people pretty much anywhere by a whole number of sites. I mean, not everyone uses Twitter, but that would be one way to do it, to kind of set up some sort of relationship with somebody. Or I use the site Couchsurfing a lot, and that's a lot of times that's for really low-budget travelers who want to crash on somebody's couch. But it's also very, very useful just to find people who live in places, and generally these are people who want to meet outsiders, and you can just get a dialogue going with them and just see if they have any suggestions. I'm in fact about to do that this afternoon for a trip I'm taking next week.
Oh, where are you going?
I am going in the middle of winter to Hungary and Romania.
Wow, bring
it's
a extremely sweater.
Cheap. Extremely, extremely cheap this
yes,
time of year.
Indeed. Kathy, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and have fun in Martinique. You can give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, getting some suggestions and talking about travel with Don George and Seth Kugel. And again, taking calls and emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. Seth, you mentioned couch surfing. There's ride sharing. There's bike sharing. It's an interesting phenomenon of travel, of sharing people's houses and their kitchen utensils and their car and perhaps their bike.
It is, I think, the dominant trend in travel today, maybe, or certainly one of the most dominant trends, and I think it's totally fantastic, and one of the reasons it's fantastic is you don't have to do it if you don't want to, but a lot of people, I think Airbnb, which is, the site where you can actually rent someone's whole home
right.
or a room in their home or something like that, is really fairly mainstream now, and people have realized that it's not a scam and that the reviews on there are generally real, and I've done it a bunch of times, and that's a good way to jump into the sharing economy, especially if you go to a place where the person is completely absent and you sort of have the whole apartment to yourself.
What about you think, John, about this sort of share economy, as Seth was just saying?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating trend, and I think it just makes so total sense that if you have a spare room and you like people from around the world, why not rent it out? And if you're a traveler, why not stay with somebody who can give you access to the local area? And I also agree, I mean, with what Seth said, that wherever you are, there are programs, there are sort of ambassador programs, and there's have a meal at home programs. There's all kinds of programs that are set up to enable you to have interactions with the local people. And these are so incredibly enriching and always a highlight of my experience when I go out of my way and a little bit out of my comfort zone to do that. And I would really, really encourage people to do that. It becomes the most special part of your trip.
Don, I have a question for you. Why do expensive hotels charge for the internet and cheaper chains do not? Do you know the answer to that?
I have a question for those expensive hotels, and that's exactly the same question. I think this is a pretty naive answer probably, but I think partly there's a legacy of people traveling on expense accounts at those big hotels and not maybe worrying so much about, it's not their dollar in a way, and I think that may be one of the reasons. I'm sure there are other more sophisticated reasons, but it's just mind-numbing to me when everyone needs Wi-Fi these days and needs internet access from their hotel rooms that you could be paying a premium for your room and on top of that more for your internet access in an expensive place just seems counterintuitive to me.
What does the frugal traveler think of that?
You know, it's obviously enraging to go to a place and find that you have to pay for internet. And I'm shocked that these places still charge for internet. I think that Don is right. I think that it is at least partially a sort of a leftover thing from people traveling on expense accounts. People, certainly business travelers, you know, even today, don't necessarily care. They need the internet, so they'll pay more for it. The question is, why don't you just raise the price to begin with and include it? That I don't understand. It's enraging, though. I would think that the negative sort of karma that you put out by charging for internet would be enough to sort of ruin your brand forever. At least I would hope so. Let's hope that does eventually happen.
We have an email actually from Alan. Do your guests think it's safe to travel in Guatemala? Don, let me toss that first to you.
I think so. I would always recommend that people check out the different advisories issued by different governments, equivalent to the Department of State, not just the U.S. Department of State, but the British and the Australian, and to see different perspectives on it. And I definitely go online and check out local publications. You know, what are the local publications writing about right now? But my sense is that it's safe to travel in Guatemala. And I think the important thing is when you're on the ground just to talk to people and get their realistic assessment of where is safe and where is not safe. And people will tell you, frankly, don't go there. Or, yeah, it's fine. As long as you don't go there between 9 and 10 a.m. when there's a demonstration planned. Mm. Or that part of town, there are pickpockets, but that other part of town is absolutely fine. That would be my take on Guatemala.
Seth, hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break, and then I'll put that same question to you after the short break. Talking with Don George and Seth Kugel about trips, where to go in 2014. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments or suggestions, give us a call. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I host Bullseye. Take pity on our poor intern, Brian. We sat him down at a computer and handed him a stack of comedy albums as high as an elephant's eye. He spent days listening to stand-up, weeks even, searching for the very best of 2013. Well, he accomplished his goal, and we'll share the results with you this week on Bullseye from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
After England and France went to war with Germany in 1939, there was a ferocious debate in America over whether the U.S. should come to their aid or go even further and enter the war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the isolationists and interventionists with Lynn Olson, author of Those Angry Days, Roosevelt, Lindbergh, and America's Fight Over World War II. It's coming out in paperback. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. Politics by natural causes. When the snow falls, so do the chips.
We have a serious and significant winter storm.
I am urging everyone to stay indoors.
Something like a snowstorm, I take very personally.
The political risks of dangerous blizzards. Who's in the storm track of bad weather when leadership comes down to snow days, plows, and power lines? Next time on The Takeaway.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's bitter cold and blustery outside. It has been snowing here in Philadelphia. Seems like a good time to do a show about trips and travel and vacation getaways. Talking with travelers and travel writers, Seth Kugel and Don George. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Seth, you wanted to respond to the question about Guatemala.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, Guatemala is okay. I agree completely with Don. I just wanted to add that a lot of times we think of a country as just sort of one unit, whereas there's, of course, there could be a whole region of Guatemala that might be dangerous. I'm not saying that there is, and the rest of it is completely fine. I mean, imagine a foreigner not coming to, going to Disney World because there's a bad neighborhood in Brooklyn they want to avoid. It doesn't really make that much sense, and so you just need to think about that. Just because, or Mexico.
All this
border violence that happened a while back and is still to some extent going on, doesn't mean you shouldn't go to Cancun.
Gotcha. Let me read an email from Megan. Summer travel ideas for a family. Has a twin 13-year-old girls and a 10-year-old son. Any places with cooler July, August temperatures? Don, do you want to tackle that one?
Cooler July, August.
Yeah, so summer travel, family, looks like three kids, two 13-year-olds and a 10-year-old.
Huh. There's a lot of options out there.
I was going to say.
one of the things that is really gaining popularity that I'll just throw out is river cruising in Europe. And it's kind of a wonderful, lovely way to see a lot of a particular country or even more than one country in an easy environment. You're in your stateroom, so you don't have to unpack and pack and pack and unpack. But you get to hop off at these different villages, and you can go out with your twins and have a wonderful, ice cream cone and get a look at a local park and get a sense of the local culture, and then go back and meet up with the boat, which cruises very slowly, so you can basically walk as fast as the boat goes. And that's something that I hear more and more people doing, multi-generational groups and family groups. And you could go to the northern climes of Europe and do this in the summer and be quite cool. So that's one thing I'd recommend.
What do you recommend, Seth?
I guess I don't have a specific recommendation, but I would just try to think about what you want to get out of the trip. And just to give one example, think about how much you want your kids to interact with the local population. And then, maybe you should go to a place, if that's important for you, that's an English-speaking country. Or maybe your kids study Spanish in school, and then you would go to a Spanish-speaking country. So, I mean, the difference between, say, going to Ireland, which I think would probably be pretty not incredibly hot in the summer, and going to, Poland or something like that, is that you can talk to everybody in Ireland, and you're going to be much more limited in your interaction with people in Poland, and I think that's really, really important especially for kids.
We have an email from Ruth from Easton saying, I have a friend in Sydney and I'm trying to decide whether to use that city and friendship as my home base and take tours from Sydney or just taking an 18-day tour to Australia and New Zealand from here sound more fiscally wise. Seth, since you're the frugal traveler, does it sound more fiscally wise?
Did he or she have a friend there?
A friend and use the friendship and the home as a home base.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that sounds great. First of all, you have that contact with the person there, and you can base yourself there, and you get acclimated, and you wouldn't even have to necessarily plan all that much before you went. You could just sit down with them and map out where you wanted to go. Obviously, you're going to be saving money on a hotel. It's also just nice to have a home base somewhere, and if it's Sydney, it has to be a place that's central, and I guess you can probably get anywhere directly from Sydney that you can get directly from it's got to be flights to New Zealand and flights all over Australia. That seems like a great idea.
Don, let me ask you about a trip you took recently to Kenya. Describe that for our listeners.
Kenya is really, really spectacular, both in terms of the wildlife, which everybody tends to think about, how you get to see the big five and what I like about it is you realize how small you are in the universe. I mean, you're really a guest in the home of all this wildlife, and you should act like a good, proper guest. That's really, really fantastic. But I also love the culture of the Maasai and the different tribes that I got to interact with. And the sort of human side of Kenya, which we don't hear about so much, was also incredibly rich. It helps put things in perspective, like travel so often does, your role on the planet and the interconnectivity of us all. And Africa is a very soaring, sort of soul-soaring experience, and it gets inside you and it stays inside you.
Seth, have you been to parts of Africa?
I have, and I'm actually planning an Africa trip for a couple months from now. It was actually my first big trip abroad. I went when I was 15 to Kenya as part of sort of a youth program. And we stayed in these, in a village. And it is so important to get integrated with people. And in Africa, I'm completely generalizing across an entire continent, but people are extremely welcoming and friendly in most cases. And that's just a great characteristic of a country that you choose to go to, as opposed to a place where people are a little bit more reserved.
Mm. And there are many countries in the continent of Africa, or on the continent of Africa, as we know. Let me get Harry from, it looks like, Northeast Philadelphia to join our conversation. And then, Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a person with a visual, physical disability, and I've thought about doing some traveling as a part of my retirement. And I have gone to Hawaii twice. I've gone to other places on business, but I've found sometimes navigating and finding out the right sources, where to go, and that sort of thing. Do you know of any resources for persons with disabilities who want to travel?
That's a very interesting question. And Don, I'm going to toss that for you first, but Seth, I'd be curious about you as well.
Off the top of my head, I can't automatically say yes, there's a great resource, but I'm sure that if you were to have someone go online for you and find out, there's a wealth of information online, and there used to be, I'm not sure that there still is, a guidebook dedicated to travelers with different disabilities that was really wonderful. I'm not sure if it's still available or not, but certainly there are so many people traveling with disabilities that there are lots of resources available, and I think if you're able to go online, you'll find great information there.
Yeah, what do you think, Seth?
I just popped online right now and just did a quick Google search, and there's several travel agencies. I'm not going to mention them because I don't know whether they're good or not.
Right.
There's several travel agencies. This is a place where a travel agent can be very helpful, and there's just a ton of information on here. So instead of saying, randomly something, I'd say get online.
There you go, Harry. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Leanne from Pennsport has to say. Leanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm wanting to travel to South America, and I'm a single woman. So what are your tips? I want to go to Machu Picchu and Costa Rica. I have a friend that lives there. But I've gone to Europe several times and traveled through hostels and even used Airbnb.
Mm-hmm.
I just wondered if there's other things I should keep in mind, because in Europe I blend easier than I will in South America.
And you're talking about travel?
Other countries and things that I might consider while I'm there. I've got a few months to play with.
Hear you. Traveling as a solo traveler, Seth.
And especially as a woman, which obviously I can't speak to personally, but when I started my job, I did interview a whole bunch of women who traveled a lot, and a lot of writers who are women. And obviously, it is a very different experience. Latin America, again, I hate to generalize, but a vast area, but there's more cat calls per block than there is in the average European city, and men can be aggressive. So that's one thing I would be worried about, but it's also something that you just sort of, in a way, have to get used to. Now, Costa Rica and Machu Picchu are two great choices of places to go, because these are places that are very used to tourism. There's a lot of resources for tourists, and you'll easily be able to meet other people. One of the things that struck me very much about when I spoke to women travel writers is how much more easily they actually meet people than solo male travelers. People tend to take them in, especially local people tend to take them in more. Even just sitting on a bus, people be worried about, why are you alone? Another woman, why are you alone here? And then you'll end up with a friend instantly, whereas I feel like I have to really be the social aggressor to make friends on the road.
Let me see what Don George has to say. Don, do you have suggestions?
In Peru, I did the tour of the whole Sacred Valley, not just Machu Picchu, but the vast valley with lots of sights, and that was really very enriching. And the other place that people don't necessarily think about as part of South America, but that I would totally recommend going to, is the Galapagos, if you're able to get there. One of the most life-changing places I've ever been. Really, really worth it. And otherwise, I think everything that Seth said is great, and I know a lot of solo women travelers, and I think that you develop a rhythm and a way of kind of dealing with the situations that arise, and you listen to your gut, and if your gut says get out, you get out. And there's an awful lot written by solo women travelers, good advice for people, so I would definitely recommend to check that out.
Leanne, thanks for the call to Radio Times, and good luck to you, and have fun as well. Don, you've been traveling and writing about travel for, what, 25 years now?
Yes.
You've been to, what, 90 countries?
Yes, right.
So what's left on your bucket list?
I still haven't gotten to Bhutan, which I think was on my bucket list the last time we talked.
I think I remember that. Yes, exactly.
So that's still on my bucket list. I really would like to get to Bhutan. That's big for some reason. I'm not quite exactly sure why, but that's big. And then I would love to actually get back to France, which is, you know, I've been there many times, but it's still a place that I love so much. I think France and Greece and Japan are my sort of touchstone, so I'd like to get back to them too. But Bhutan is big on my bucket list.
And Seth, do you have a place that just calls to you?
Well, this is easy for me because I started out as a sort of a Latin America specialist, not really a travel writer, even just a reporter. And there are large places, plenty of places in the world I haven't been. The most glaring are, as I mentioned before, Indonesia, but even more glaring is India, which is, as we know, just an entire subcontinent with more than a billion people living in it. I feel like I really need to get there soon.
Let me see what looks like Steve from Doylestown has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, my question is mainly for Don, but since Seth just brought up India, I would highly recommend Agra, the Taj at sunrise. But that's off my topic.
It's okay.
I lived in Indonesia 40 years ago and was actually, I got to Bali 38 years ago. And I wonder, I know it probably can't be done for the same budget, Don, but are there ways, for example, we were staying in what they were called Los Mons or hostels for $2 a day, renting a motorcycle for $10 a day. But what is the, I'd love to take my family back there, but what is the, would the budget traveler find in Bali these days?
Don, go ahead.
You can still stay in a Los Mons for $5 a night. It's just sort of, you have to move out. I mean, I remember 30 years ago, I could stay in Ubud for $5 a night. You can't stay in Ubud, really, for $5 a night. Well, you probably could, but you might not want to. But if you move farther out toward, you know, just farther into the hinterlands, you can definitely still find places where you can stay for a few dollars a night. You can rent a motorbike for about what you did 38 years ago. And it's still there. The riches that you found 38 years ago are still there in Bali. You just kind of have to go a little bit farther out into the countryside to find them.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Ellen from Newtown Square has to say. Ellen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My daughter's going abroad to Barcelona on Monday for the semester, a college student, and I'm wondering about the travel safety in that area.
What you mean when she gets to Barcelona?
Yeah, when she's in Barcelona spending, you know, 4 or 5 months there, I'm just concerned about, I've heard they have a very high rate of unemployment and, you know, theft, et cetera.
And she'll be staying in a dorm with a family? In a dorm.
In a dorm.
Seth, can you tackle that?
Sure. I don't particularly think that travel in Spain is dangerous. I mean, you're in the most, probably the safest continent for travel in the world, and I doubt she'll be staying just in Spain either. I would encourage her to get out and around. My big piece of advice is don't get on a Vespa. Tell her not to go on any Vespas.
For all the obvious reasons, right?
Exactly. It can be tempting, though.
Indeed. Don, anything you want to add to that?
Well, actually, Marty, I forgot to tell you this, but I was just in Barcelona. I don't know how that slipped my brain. But it was just before Christmas I was in Barcelona, and the mood was incredibly festive, and if there were economic problems, they certainly weren't visible. The restaurants were full. The cafes were overflowing. The shops were doing a brisk business. So I came away from Barcelona with a sense that this is one of the great cities of Europe, and I envy your child to have the opportunity to live there. I think she'll have a fantastic time and just, you know, adopt the usual precautions, but I think she'll have an amazing time. And good for her.
Yeah, good for her. Lucky,
change her life.
Lucky her as well. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Seth, I've interviewed Don George a couple of times, and we only have about 45 seconds. How did you become the Frugal Traveler?
Well, I don't mean to frustrate people, but I just kind of got asked to be the Frugal Traveler.
Really?
I was a writer, and the editor at the time, he had this big thing about, you know, he'd rather have writers who travel than travel writers. And so I wasn't a travel writer, but I had done a lot of work for him, and I had been doing some travel writing, but essentially I got plucked out of it. I think the larger question is, you know, you need to travel a lot, you need to travel independently, and then try to turn it into a writing career.
And did they know, were you frugal before you were the Frugal
Traveler? Yes, very frugal, frugal. I probably, you know, in the articles I did for them, my budget probably came in, my expenses came in. They were probably shocked them by how little I had spent compared to other writers.
Well, it's been great fun to talk to both of you. Seth Kugel, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And Don George, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty. Happy travels.
Happy travels to both of you and to our listeners as well. You can check out Don George's blog at don-george.com, and you can read Seth Kugel's columns for the New York Times. He is the Frugal Traveler. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including email and podcasts and Twitter and Facebook and Sirius Satellite Radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.